Hello, everybody. My name is Yacid Ortega, and I have some news to tell you, all of you who have supported Chasing Encounters for the past few years. Chasing Encounters have been my dear podcast in which I engage with others, could be students or professionals, teachers, scholars, anybody who wants to share the stories, who wants to share their original work, who wants to share their research or their ideas related to education. I always engage with them on a personal level because I would like to know more about who they are and what they're bringing to the profession of language education and research. So today marks the end of Chasing Encounters because I'm moving on into new adventures in my life. And I hope you have enjoyed this podcast. I know a lot of people have listened to the podcast. The episodes are going to be here until God knows whenever this stops. But these are going to be here for you to go back and listen to some of our conversations. But I just wanted to take a moment to say thank you to all of you who have been following me for a while. Like I said, I'm going to be in new adventures, going to new places, etc. And as such, I am in Northern Ireland in Belfast and at Queen's University Belfast specifically. And part of this adventure, I got the chance to meet a visiting scholar from Spain. His name is Alonso Mateo, and we had a great conversation about his work, about the things that he has been doing in Spain, but also in connection with other projects in Europe through the Erasmus project. So what you will be hearing in the next part is my conversation with Alonso related to his work. So with any further ado, thank you so much once again, and I'm gonna allow the space here for our conversation with Alonso. Alonso is gonna tell us a little bit about the work that you do. Tell us who you are.
Sure.
Where you coming from?
I'm Alonso from, as you said, from La Mancha. I was born in a little village in one of the, let's say, borders of La Mancha. It's like at the end of La Mancha, and we start off a chain of mountains there. So I'm very near to the province of Valencia. So it's between Albacete and Valencia. Mm-hmm. I was born there, but when I was around 4 or 5 years old, my family moved to Germany. They emigrated there. So I spent most of my childhood, up to I was 13 years old, mm-hmm. Living in Germany, in Hamburg.
So you speak German?
Yeah.
Wow, that's good to know. So you speak Spanish, English, and German.
And German.
Any other language that I don't know?
No, just a few words Italian and a few words French, but that's it.
Well, this is good. You're a truly plurilingual person.
Yeah, hopefully.
That's great. Yeah. So you're coming from this part of Spain. Mm. And how is it living in Spain? How did you like it? Tell us a little bit about Spain in general.
Yeah, well, Spain, for me, it's a very great place to live. I like it a lot. I remember being a child living in Germany, for instance, that I think maybe because of my parents were like telling us, like looking forward coming back to Spain, mm-hmm. to live in our country and so on. Initially, when I came back the first year, well, it was fine, but it changed, you know, from a big city to a small village, mm-hmm. Was a bit harsh. So after some time, I thought that I was okay in Spain, but I wanted to move somewhere else. So I kept studying secondary education. Then I moved to Albacete. And well, Albacete has been the place where I've been living most of the time since I was a teenager, except 1 year that I spent in London, and 1 year in my military service that it was in Cartagena. I've been living most of the time in Albacete. And particularly Albacete within Spain, well, it's not one of the, you know, Spain has got many beautiful cities, Albacete is not one of them. It's not a really a beautiful city, but it's a very comfortable city. It's a very good place to live in. We have many places to be, many facilities for different types of people, many cafes, restaurants. There's a lot of outdoor life. We have a beautiful fair in September. It's really amazing and very funny. So Albacete is really a very nice place to live. So there is where I'm living. Mm-hmm. There I live with my family. I'm married. I have two boys. Mm-hmm. And yeah, that's
more well. Fun. That sounds interesting and sounds fun because you know, as a person who have lived abroad for so long, the only places that I always know from Spain are either Barcelona or Madrid,
yeah.
And that's pretty much it.
But getting that's mostly difficult for everybody, I think. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
But getting to know a person from a
when you say I'm from Spain, yeah, Real Madrid.
Yeah, exactly. But we don't know much about these other places because of what we hear, you know, all the time, Barcelona. And Madrid all the time. But I'm glad to know you, and I'm glad to know that you are from a place that we don't hear much. That's why I wanted to hear a little bit more about where you live and where you have been living in the past. Well, now that we know a little bit about you and who you are and where you're coming from, one of the things that we do here in this podcast for the Center for Language Education Research is talking about language and talking about education and talking about research. So we're moving a little bit into your background in terms of professional. I understand that you have a background in teaching.
Yeah.
So tell us a little bit about those initial stages of becoming a teacher. When did you become a teacher? When do you have this idea of I'm gonna become a teacher?
Yeah, good question. So trying to recall exactly when I thought about becoming a teacher, I think it was after my military service. I came back to my city, to Albacete. I studied a vocational course about social cultural education and so on. I realized that this was not mine. I really didn't want to work on it. But then I realized that I like teaching. It was like we had to do some practices in schools and so on. And I really realized that this would be something that I would like. So once I finished the course, the vocational course, the year after, I started in the education faculty in Albacete to the studies to become a primary school teacher in the specialty of English. So that was like my very beginning. I liked very much the degree. I enjoyed it quite a lot, and especially the practical period when we had to go to schools. The school placement in the last year was very good. I enjoyed it a lot. And then I really realized that I wanted to be a teacher.
Nice.
So after finishing the degree, I went 1 year to London to improve my English and to work and just, have some experiences. Then I came back and I started a few months after coming back. I started working in a school as primary school teacher and English specialist. So I was doing that for 10 years, then 10 courses, and then I switched into special education. I was working with special educational needs children at different levels, from preschool to secondary school, so preschool, primary, and secondary school. And then, some years after, I started switching. I kept working with special education kids, but I switched, I added like new things to my duties, and one of this was the coordination of Erasmus projects, international school projects, We started in 2013 with that. We had like a first attempt. We joined other schools that were working on a project.
So before we move into that part of your life,
yeah,
because I know it's very interesting, that part of your academic life, I am a little bit curious about your work as a teacher, an English teacher in primary,
yeah,
and especially primary / preschool as well. And because this podcast is about storytelling and a little bit of narrative, I want you to hear from you any story that you recall as a teacher teaching English in primary school that you think it was interesting, it was motivating for your students, it was in which you saw your students engaging in learning. But the reason why I'm asking you this question is because I was also an English teacher in primary school.
Huh.
And one of the things that I remember a lot is children being fascinated about singing, dancing, and playing games. So yeah. They were never interested in like learning the verb to be or the numbers or the colors.
No, never ever.
But they were mainly interested in, when are we going to sing songs? When are we going to dance? When are we going to play games?
Yeah, exactly.
So my classes at that time were about exactly that, playing games, singing songs and dancing. I became like a little clown with this kid. So I want you to, if you recall anything that you remember when you were those 10 years spending this time with these students in primary school, is there anything that you can remember on those days?
Yeah, you are completely right. I mean, when it comes to working with, especially with primary school children and in English, it is very important to sing, to play, to make games, to because that's like to dance, because that's what really moves them and makes them get interested in the language, I think, right? So there are many experiences. I remember one activity we made that and they liked a lot. It was like a scavenger's hunt. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they were like, I was like hitting cues. They had to follow throughout the class. They had to find a character. And then that character was letting them to other solutions. And so it was very nice. They enjoyed it a lot. And yeah, in general, those types of activities were, I think, the best ones. It was also useful because sometimes when, for instance, I planned, and you know, dialogues, they were like maybe using with cards, talking around with each other in the classroom, in pairs and so on. Sometimes I realized, for instance, it's good to readjust and to tune a bit the content that you are using with the kids, because sometimes you realize that it's too difficult or it's, the text is too complex, and then to step back a bit in order to make it easier for the kids, right? So, but in general, I remember that the active part was very good.
Right.
Yeah.
The $1 million question: did you use Spanish when you were teaching these little kids, or do you have to use English 100% all the time?
In my case, I use Spanish. Okay. I tried to use as much English as possible, but English was not. Spanish was not banned in the classroom. So I used. I tried to use it as less as possible, but. I use mainly English and part some Spanish.
Yeah, I agree with you, because sometimes students and especially children don't know much, as you said, about the instructions. Or when you present a task to do, you know, an activity, sometimes they don't know what you want them to do. So you have to flip back to your home language to explain.
Yeah, exactly. I think probably giving instructions is the most complicated thing to do with pupils in primary schools, like, or if you are, for instance, explaining an exercise or whatever, like following like different types of instructions and so on, it must be a bit difficult for them. So in those cases, it's good to try to translate when you find that it's necessary. But especially for a short command, it's good to, well, mainly to use English, but then if somebody misses something, to repeat it in Spanish, because in the end everybody knows how to say, or they understand everything, like, hey, please sit down, or could you come to the blackboard or whatever, or then they know how to ask you how to go to the toilet and things like that, right? Mm-hmm. So it's like, let's say, like, ordinary language should be introduced on a daily basis, but never trying to ban the use of Spanish or first language in order to facilitate their language acquisition, right?
No, good, good. I'm glad to hear this, especially for our audience. This is one good example that we're going to try to send the message. When you teach a language or any language, it does not hurt to allow their other languages in the classroom for the purposes of understanding each other, understanding instruction, for the purposes of mini-making. For example, I think it's important, and what Alonso has said today is one of the key elements of language education, especially when the students are at a younger age. So I'm glad to hear that. Now, moving on to the second part that I wanted you to talk about, because I know moving from primary to secondary, you also, after those 10 years of working with special education students and primary students, you started moving into another part of education, which is the Erasmus project or program in Europe. But before you telling us your experience with the Erasmus project, maybe you tell our audience, what is the Erasmus project or the Erasmus program? What is this about? Because a lot of our audience may not know what that is. What is that thing? Yeah. And then you let us know your experience in this program.
Yeah, the Erasmus program is a European Union program, which was created initially in the late 80s, in 1987. There was like the first Erasmus program. The first one was only for university students and staff. And then other programs like Comenius, Grundtvig, Leonardo da Vinci were added for school education, vocational education, adult education. Mm-hmm. So we had like loads of different names of programs, but the spirit was trying to foster internationalization within the European Union, trying to make institutions cooperate in around projects. This was the essence of the Erasmus program. Mm. So in 2014, this, let's say, forest of different programs was unified in terms of names. Since 2014, the name of all those names switched into Erasmus Plus program. Mm. So Erasmus Plus program includes everything that we had before: university education, secondary education, vocational education, nice. And adult education, right? The point is that in 2014, when they started with a new program, there were many chances, for instance, for schools to do joint projects. So there was even a better budget than before to implement those projects. So the previous Comenius project were transformed into Erasmus Plus K2 actions, K-Action 2, for school education. And this spirit, although it is a European Union initiative, it includes also other countries throughout Europe, for instance, Norway, Turkey, Iceland, and some other countries are included in the Erasmus Plus experience. So this is very interesting in terms of fostering partnerships beyond the European Union. Unfortunately, when the United Kingdom left the European Union, they also abandoned. They didn't have the need to abandon it, because there are many countries that don't that are not part of the European Union, but take part in it, but they abandoned also additionally the Erasmus program. Mm. So now we don't have the possibility within this program to make projects with either European schools or universities or other types of educational institutions. Yeah, that's the point. Wow. So before the new program started, in our case, 2013, we tried to apply to a first project. We joined a group of schools that were working on already on a project about safety culture applied to education and so on. We applied for it and we didn't get it. So it was our first attempt, we didn't get it. But then the year after, with the new Erasmus program, we applied for a new project and we got it. And since then, we were like quite lucky because we got like three projects in a row, 2014-16, 16-18, and 18-20. Additionally, we got another project approved, which was K-Action 1 for Erasmus. K-Action 1 is devoted to fostering mainly mobilities of teachers throughout different institutions. So we had teachers like moving around Europe to either to receive training or to make a job shadowing in schools or to give some, to offer some courses in other schools. So this was also a very interesting project. About the joint projects that we had, if you want, I could tell you a bit about.
I think one thing that I want to know before you move into your own experience, when you say we got this project, we won this project, you refer to you and your peers in your school, because you were teaching at the time in a secondary school, so I'm assuming you applied with your peers in secondary school to the Erasmus Plus project.
Exactly, yeah. And we won together with the other schools.
Okay, with the other schools. And what did you do with the schools? Tell us one example of this project.
Okay, for instance, the first project that we applied for and got it, the 2014 one. First, we found people interested through a tuning. We use mainly a tuning to know people, to know the teachers who would be interested in joining projects. So we found through eTwinning by just posting on the forum, okay, we have got this project about recent history. If anybody's interested, you can text me, send me an email, whatever. So through this platform, we found many different people who were interested in the project from other schools around Europe. And we started working together. So we had the topic, we had the same goal, which was getting a school association approved and getting the budget for doing all those activities. And then we started working, the work process was mainly, going to the draft of the application form, see what questions you have to answer, the structure you want to give into it, organize it, make a timetable, plan activities, mobilities, who is going to have each role in each of the institutions. And basically it's working quite hard on the project. It's writing, trying to coordinate properly with the rest of the partners, which is not always easy. We made it through video calls, also through, in this case, we had also a previous meeting, some of the partners came to Spain to work directly for a week there with us, coping with the project. And once we had that, we applied, so the consortium applied. And after a few months, when we got the evaluation, in our case, we appeared on the list of the approved projects, because it's like the application is not, you don't get the grant automatically. There's some money which has to be shared, and just a number of institutions get them. In our case, the first project, I think the rates were like 30% of the projects which had been presented were approved. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And this is basically the work process that we had for every project. So first finding partner and project that we made after, also we reused, let's say, some partners. So some previous partners joined us in new projects. But basically finding partners or just joining previous partners and then just writing the projects and applying for it.
Yeah. So does these projects mean that some people from the parties, different parties, they travel to different places,
exactly,
from different countries to countries doing different projects.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So can you explain to us which places or countries or cities did you travel with and your students, and what kind of projects did you do with your students?
Yeah. For instance, our first project was about social sciences. It was called Recent European History Through Personal Histories. And on the basis of this topic, which was mainly trying to research about the history of the participating countries through making interviews with the relatives of the pupils. So the pupils made interviews to their relatives, then they translated the subtitles and wrote them in the screen and so on, in order to have like some research material, right? And we made like activities before the mobilities and also during the mobilities. Mm-hmm. In our case, we were six partners. We were partners from Spain, Germany, Romania, Poland, Turkey, and Portugal. And we made one mobility in each country. Mm-hmm. So in every mobility that we made, for instance, in the first one that we met in Albacete in Spain, in this one we had only teachers. We were like joining in order to prepare properly the rest of the project. Mm-hmm. And then the rest of the mobilities were in, the next one was in Germany, for instance, and then in Germany, we met teachers and students from the rest of the partner countries. So there we made activities related to the project. So it was like we have bringing, for instance, questions that the students had been doing previously at home, or recordings of the interviews and so on. And also we made cultural and leisure activities. So it was normally we spent 1 week in every place, and we had loads of activities, quite a filled schedule. The experience normally was quite good for everybody, or at least almost everybody. Especially the kids enjoyed it a lot. They were living with host families, with their peer students. They were during the week that we normally spent in each place, they were living with host families, and normally that experience was very nice. Mm-hmm. And also being with their peers, with their peer students who hosted them, and also were together in the activities and so on, was very nice for them. So I can say that after even such a short period of time, after maybe 7-8 days, in the end you could see that it had really produced a huge impact on children, on the way they were like interacting to each other, the links that they created mm-hmm. among each other. So that was very nice. And I think apart from the fact that the pupils learned a lot in terms of using English throughout the time they were there, trying to socialize with different types of people from different countries, the human factor was also very important, and I think it was very enriching in general, and somehow it broadened their view about the life and the world.
No, definitely, absolutely. I really like the work that you have done, especially as a person who is a critical scholar and decolonial scholar. I am very interested in these projects that connect people and communities and humanizing education and research as well. Because the work that you did with these students, teachers, and communities jumping from one country to another country to learn about their histories, I think it's something that I believe is missing in education, that connection part to others.
Yeah.
Meaning in different places, because sometimes we connect in the same school, in the same classroom, which is fine. But I like it, this idea of connecting, or beyond the classroom.
Yeah.
Moving into real spaces when the students ask real questions to their relatives, parents, grandparents, about their history 20, 30, 50 years ago. So this way, students are learning history from their own people, and then sharing and connecting with others these histories. So that's something that really beautifully, and that's why I enjoy the work that you have done. Because it reminds me of some work that I have done in the past with a few communities in the American continent, around the lines of something that is called testimonios, and another methodology that is called el círculo de la palabra or el círculo de la memoria, which is getting together with students, parents, grandparents, abuelos, abuelas, you know, and getting to know a little bit about who you are, where you're coming from, and sort of revive that history that was lost, and using them as a pedagogical approach for history, for learning history. I'm glad to hear these experiences. Is there any in this trajectory that you've been working in the Erasmus and Erasmus Plus project, is there anything that stands out on all the projects that you have been working on that you remember that you, oh my God, I remember this when this student, this teacher, this project, anything that you remember?
Well, standing out, there can be many things, but I think throughout the different projects, what we can, at least my impression is that what we can say that stood out in common was that the human factor. Independently from what we were working on, from what type of topic we were dealing with, the human factor was very important in each of the projects, and the way we met people, we dealt with pupils and teachers from other places. So this interaction was throughout the different projects. I think the common, let's say, output, the main output in terms of learning, right? So it's like independently from what we were working on, there was something behind that was, I think, quite important. And also in terms of learning, but not just basically the contents that we had to do, but it's also something in terms of human beings, right? So
absolutely, the human factor is the common thread in these projects, and I like that. I also understand that you are a university professor as well in a teacher education program, right?
Yes.
And how would you translate all of this knowledge and exercises that you have done through the Erasmus project and now as a professor in a teacher education program, also teaching in a master's program? How do you translate that experience into your own teaching?
Well, it influences me, I think, in different ways, because especially if we are trying to teach future language teachers, right? They have to be aware about the one of the important facts that languages are about, which is a tool for communication, for linking people, for linking individuals, but also for linking countries and different types of persons, right? This is very important. I try to transmit it throughout my lessons, independently from the course, either the master or the grade course that I'm teaching. And also I try to transmit them the, well, a bit of my own experience, and to encourage them to do such things when they are teachers. So the point is that there are many resources that we can use as teachers, as primary school teachers, apart from Erasmus projects, for instance, e-training projects, or trying to use online platforms like School Education Gateway and so on, which can be helpful to create such cooperations, mainly by using new technologies, which can be a very interesting instrument in order to, for instance, share materials, activities, videos, exchange pictures from pupils, let them know each other. So there are many possibilities to do things in this way. And this is something that I think that our students from the university should seize in the future, especially being language teachers. They should realize that language has to be a tool in order to connect people. And well,
I agree with you, Alonso. I think something that I have taken away from your conversation today is something that I want our audience to understand and also take away, is how we as teachers and educators teach language for the purposes of communication, of course, but how can we use it as a tool to connect to the other? and understand where the other is coming from. And because now we are sort of moving beyond the pandemic, how we can use online resources, as you mentioned, to connect even beyond our neighbors. Because I know with the Erasmus project, there was some funding that you could travel physically with the students and teachers to country from country to country. Now, there may be some schools anywhere in the world, they don't may not have the money to do such a thing, to move teachers and students from one country to the other.
Exactly.
But we have ICT, as you mentioned the other day, the ICT technology, right? Like internet and what other tools out there that we can also connect and move beyond the classroom, move beyond the city and the country. And now it's become this idea of globally I can connect, right? So what do you think would be the future in general of education or the education of languages, and your future as a professor, educator, researchers, etc.?
Well, the future about language education, I think, should go towards trying to, be or implement every time more active methodologies, so to really be able to engage students in learning and to make it attractive to them, because this is, I think, essential. If we are able to engage pupils, they are going to like languages. If not, if we use methodologies that are just going to a textbook and doing some grammar activities, I think we are lost. So they have to seize the point of learning languages, which I think socially now is a very good moment for, because they are quite surrounded by, for instance, in the case of Spain, our kids and teenagers are surrounded by English much more than ever, probably in the previous history, right? They are exposed to songs, to podcasts, to internet games, to online connections with other people. So this surrounding should be seized in order to make languages interesting for our pupils, right? And I think the future should also, in addition to this, to trying to bring to the classroom active methodologies, we should also try to use the international potential of language teaching. So, and this is what we mentioned before, like going to those type of joint projects, either in person or online, in order to be able to build bridges and to bring together different types of students and teachers, right?
Yeah. Right, and being this is a good example of bridging knowledges. The fact that we have Alonso here at Queen's University Belfast in our department is because of that idea of understanding and learning from others, and then we are learning from Alonso's work, and then we hope that Alonso is also learning something from us, not necessarily at the university, but even from the city or from things that you have learned in the city, right? And so just so everybody knows, Alonso is here as a visiting scholar for a limited time. So that's why we are interviewing him, to get to know more about him. But now that you've been here for a while in Belfast, and I know you've been in the past, but now you're here more on a professional basis, is there anything that you want to share with that audience that you liked about Belfast, that you enjoy, that you have seen, that you like?
Many things, yeah. Well, first, starting with King's University, I'm very happy to be here. I mean, I'm really enjoying people. I felt from the beginning very welcome, so I really can't complain. I feel I'm taking part in activities like, for instance, this podcast, so I'm really enjoying my stay here. Although I have a lot of work from my home university to do, I'm coordinating things still. This morning I was doing loads of stuff from there, but yeah, that's fine. As for the university, and also I'm feeling I'm learning about trying to find aspects in common for future cooperation, because I think this is a great opportunity to work in the future together and to find joint interests in order to make research and so on, right? And about Belfast, well, I already knew the city, but now I like it even more. I'm experiencing it a lot. I like very much the people. I like very much the way the city is, how welcoming everybody is in most of the places, how easy it is to know new people. And well, this is being a great experience for me. Yeah,
this is good. Yes, definitely, I agree with you. We are little by little wrapping up today's conversation with Alonso, but I just wanted to mention that I'm happy to have Alonso here with us, telling us about the experiences and sharing with us all the knowledge that you have. But one of the highlights of today's conversation, it's about what is the point of teaching? What is the point of teaching a language, any language, right? And language teaching means how can teachers can make the teaching meaningful and active meaningfulness, I guess. Actively meaningful, I guess. That's the word that I was looking for. Actively meaningful. Right, that we invite our audience to start thinking and put it in the back and then in the front of your mind, how can I engage my students in a meaningful way so they find the motivation they need to learn language, so they can use the language to connect, to build bridges, and to learn from others as well. So for that reason, I'm going to thank Alonso for being here today. Gracias por venir. Thank you so much for coming today. Have a wonderful rest of the afternoon.
Thank you. Gracias.
Bye.